It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why hormones are showing up in Wisconsin wells and what might be to blame for it. First, the story of a mysterious particle that eluded scientists for decades, and while it's still pretty hard to find, the neutrino continues to be a hot topic for scientists all over the world. That's including researchers from here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Their Antarctic Ice Cube project just won the 2013 Breakthrough of the Year Award from the British magazine Physics World. We're joined now by Ray Jayawardena. He's professor of astrophysics at the University of Toronto. He's got a new book out. It's called Neutrino Hunters, The Thrilling Chase for a Ghostly Particle to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Ray, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is a neutrino?
A neutrino is an elementary particle. Neutrinos are incredibly tiny bits of matter. They are quite intriguing because of their characteristics. They carry no electric charge, and they zip right through our bodies and, in fact, right through the entire Earth and travel back into space. As every second of every day and night, trillions of these ghostly particles travel through our bodies. Luckily, they don't do any harm and they leave no trace.
This is one of the things I love about physics to the extent that I understand it. The neutrino, as you write, was discovered mathematically first, right? There was some missing energy that people were trying to account for, and they hypothesized that this thing was out there.
Indeed. A brash young physicist by the name of Wolfgang Pauli literally kind of conjured up this new particle in 1930 to solve a growing crisis in physics, where for decades people saw that whenever there was beta decay of radioactive elements, a type of radioactive decay, some energy seemed to go missing. And back then, this was a radical step because only two matter particles were known back then. And all of a sudden, he wanted to add a third with not a whole lot of direct evidence. So it was a big step. And in fact, soon afterwards, within a year or so, he made this comment that I have done a terrible thing. I have postulated a particle that cannot be detected. And it took some 25 years before physicists could trap it experimentally.
Why is it so hard to detect these things?
Because neutrinos hardly ever interact with any other particles. They are only subject to what's called the weak nuclear force or the weak interaction. So because they have no charge, they don't feel electromagnetism, and they're not subject to the strong nuclear force. So that means they, you know, hardly have a chance to interact with anything else. I describe them as pathologically shy, in fact, because of their tendency to not mingle.
We'll get into some of the efforts to detect neutrinos, including the Ice Cube project I mentioned. But first, what can neutrinos tell us about what's out there in space?
Quite a lot, in fact. And neutrinos can tell us about what's happening at the heart of the sun, the nuclear furnace that's producing the energy at the core of the sun. They can tell us about exploding stars far, far away, because those explosions produce huge bursts of neutrinos. They are produced actually in the upper atmosphere of the Earth when particles from space called cosmic rays bombard us. And when those cosmic rays collide with atoms in the Earth's atmosphere, that produces neutrinos, and they are produced beneath our feet as well. The radioactive elements inside the Earth, as they decay, also produce neutrinos. So they're literally all around us, and they can tell us a lot about what's happening on a cosmic scale, but they have also taught physicists a great deal about the shenanigans of the subatomic world.
And I just saw a piece you wrote where you have seven possible uses for neutrinos and the likelihood. Can you give us a couple of likely things that we can use our understanding of neutrinos for here on planet Earth?
Indeed, these esoteric particles that we've studied until recently for their own sake might someday be of practical use here, right here on Earth. One of the most seriously investigated prospects is the idea of using neutrinos for nuclear proliferation monitoring. In other words, whenever a nuclear reactor is operating or whenever somebody tests a nuclear device, that would produce neutrinos. And there's no way to hide that because the neutrinos escape from their birth sites with hardly any loss. So they escape from where they're produced, and that means that if you could have a neutrino detector nearby a nuclear reactor, you could keep tabs on it. You could make sure that the people who are operating it aren't up to any mischief, that they're indeed doing what they claim to be doing. They're not switching the fuel rods too often, and really keep tabs on it. So it might give, for example, the International Atomic Energy Authority monitors another way of and a better way of keeping tabs on nuclear proliferation. There have been some other, perhaps what you might call wilder suggestions, including the idea of using neutrinos for communications, because they could traverse the Earth right through the core of the Earth instead of having to go around. You might save a few milliseconds if you could use neutrino beams to communicate from one side of the Earth to the other.
Well, talking about the nuclear proliferation issue reminds me of one of the early ways talked about to try to detect neutrinos. This one didn't seem very practical to do again and again. Somebody was going to have their detector set up underneath the detonation of a 20 megaton nuclear bomb.
Indeed. It does seem a far out idea right now. But the physicists who thought of this was back in the 1950s when for the first time physicists were trying to figure out ways of detecting neutrinos, they realized that nuclear detonations would be one of the most powerful sources of neutrinos. And for those physicists that were chasing neutrinos, it didn't seem that crazy because they had worked on the Manhattan Project. They were familiar with nuclear devices. So their first thought was, why not use the most powerful source of neutrinos we know of locally to detect them? Luckily, they didn't go forward with that scheme. Instead, they decided that they would try to detect neutrinos leaking from a nuclear power generator or nuclear reactor, where you don't get a huge burst, but you do have a continuous flux of neutrinos, and that's what succeeded.
Speaking of the Manhattan Project, that was a thing that a few governments actually had a big interest in, brought together a number of the best scientific minds they had available to them. A lot of personalities, a lot of people. The hunt for neutrinos, not as much, fewer and farther between. What motivated the people who were trying to detect those neutrinos?
Well, there was a lot of interest in neutrinos in the 1930s after Pauli had suggested their possible existence. But of course, with the advent of the Second World War, a lot of physicists on both sides of the Atlantic turned their attention towards the war effort. That meant, for the most part, neutrinos research took a back seat. But on the other hand, in the aftermath of the Second World War, some of these physicists were looking for new areas of research to pursue. They were looking for unsolved problems that they could take on. And that's when the interest in neutrinos returned. And in fact, some of the skills they had developed in the war effort, such as working with nuclear reactors and other devices, came in handy when it came time for them to think of clever ways of trapping these rather ghostly and elusive particles.
We're talking with Ray Jayawardena about the mysterious particle known as the neutrino. His new book is called Neutrino Hunters. Coming up, we'll talk about the efforts to detect it and the people who are in the hunt. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We have physicist Ray Jayawardena with us now. He is the author of the new book, Neutrino Hunters, talking about the hunt for the elusive subatomic particle called a neutrino. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about a Wisconsin connection by way of Antarctica. If you have a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Ray, a lot of colorful characters in this story. You mentioned Wolfgang Pauli, a brash young hotshot who came up with the idea of neutrinos. The hunt took a weird Cold War turn with, I'll mispronounce this for you, Ettore Majorana from Italy originally, I think.
Yes, indeed, there were a number of colorful characters. Ettore Majorana was one of them. This reclusive genius of a physicist was quite involved and interested in neutrino behavior. And one fine day, he disappeared without a trace at age 32. Presumably while on a boat from Sicily back to Naples, where he had a teaching position. There was no indication that he intended to commit suicide. His family never heard from him again. His colleagues never heard from him again. It's possible he jumped off the boat, but there were also lots of conspiracy theories surrounding his disappearance. People talked about the mob getting to him. Others talked about the possibility that he might have had a crisis of faith and joined a monastery, or that he may have absconded to South America. All sorts of stories swirling around his disappearance. In fact, it is said that for many years in Italy, there were Majorana sightings, kind of like Elvis sightings in the United States.
Oh, and I had actually rolled him up with Pontecorvo, another Italian who disappeared and ended up in the Soviet Union.
Indeed, at the height of the Cold War in 1950, with a lot of fear and worry about red spies, this Italian physicist who had immigrated first to the United States, then to Canada, and finally to Britain, where he was working at an atomic research laboratory, while on vacation over the summer with his family on the European continent, all of a sudden went missing, and the whole family went missing, and there was a lot of fear that he had perhaps all along been a Russian spy, or at least that he had taken some nuclear secrets with him behind the Iron Curtain. It made headlines around the world, his disappearance. And a few years later, he did show up at a press conference in Moscow and talked about his decision to defect. So indeed, there were many, and those are just two of the colorful characters that I write about in Neutrino Hunters. People, you know, there's quite a cast of them that have been involved in neutrino research over the years.
Getting back to the hunt, it seems like all of the detection methods you describe, the first priority is to get underground. Why?
Great question. So the challenge of detecting neutrinos is twofold. One, because they hardly ever interact with anything, you need a very large volume for your detector. You need a very, a gigantic contraption. And the other is that there's a lot of noise around. In other words, there are a lot of other particles that you might confuse with the signals from neutrinos, the signals due to neutrinos. So you want to try to filter out the rest of that noise. The reason for going underground or indeed deep under the ice is to use the Earth itself or a thick layer of ice as a filter, because those other particles cannot penetrate through a mile or mile and a half of ground, and yet neutrinos have no trouble getting right through that. So you'd be, in effect, using the Earth or a thick layer of ice as a filter to filter out other particles and therefore hone in on the neutrinos.
You spent some time, I think it was a mile or more underground, in a nickel mine near Sudbury, Ontario. What was that like to be that far under the surface?
It was pretty exciting. I mean, it was, this is something that miners do every day, right? So we took the open cage down, the elevator cage down with the miners at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then trekked through some mile and a half of a tunnel, a muddy, dirty tunnel, to arrive at the world's deepest physics lab, where you go through this elaborate cleaning ritual. You change from your overalls take a shower, change into a different set of overalls and a hairnet, and then walk through an air shower to get rid of any other remaining dust before you're allowed to enter the inner sanctum. And the inner sanctum is, you know, drastically different. It's incredibly clean. There's no dust in the air, shiny walls and floors. So quite a contrast from the grime of the mine outside. And the other ironic thing about it is this Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, as it's called, was built to peer at the heart of the sun. And it is deep underground where the sun never shines.
Hmm. To filter out all the cosmic rays and whatnot.
Exactly.
Well, let's visit Antarctica now. Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, operates the Ice Cube Observatory. How do they work? How are they different from that Sudbury operation?
The Sudbury operation and some of the other neutrino detectors consist of huge vats or tanks filled with either dry cleaning fluid or heavy water or some other medium that traps neutrinos, or you hope that a few neutrinos would interact with the atoms of that medium. In the case of Ice Cube, it's quite a brilliant design where the scientists are using the ice itself as the medium of the detector, of the neutrino detector. And they had to go deep enough under the South Pole so that there are no air bubbles trapped in the ice. They needed the ice to be very clear and very clean. That way, when a neutrino interacts with an atom in the ice, it produces another particle called a muon. And when a muon travels through the ice, it leaves a faint blue trail. That is the trail that tells you that a neutrino has just arrived. In other words, you're not seeing the neutrino directly. You're getting a whiff of its presence by its interaction. And the scientists took a risky gamble and an expensive one in building this novel detector. They had a predecessor instrument called Amanda that they had worked with and tested. And Ice Cube really is starting to pay off already. They've sunk literally some 5,000 optical sensors into the ice. They drilled really deep holes into which they lowered cables with these optical sensors, kind of basketball-sized optical sensors hanging on those cables. And they're now permanently buried in the ice, and the Ice Cube Observatory works beautifully. It's the world's biggest neutrino detector at the moment. And as you might know, just in the past month or so, they've announced some of their first results.
What have they found? What was the news from their results?
The news is that they've detected neutrinos coming from far outside our solar system for only the second time in history. They just reported only the second batch of neutrinos ever seen from beyond our solar system. The first set of neutrinos was back in 1987 when a supernova exploded in a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. That's 2 dozen neutrinos that were detected by 3 different neutrino detectors around the globe. What Ice Cube has detected are some 28 events so far in the first 2 years of its operation. That's not a very a large rate. It's about one neutrino detection per month, roughly speaking. And yet, it's quite a big deal because now that marks the beginnings of neutrino astronomy, the detection of energetic cosmic neutrinos that might soon tell us something about some of the most violent corners and phenomena of the universe, because we expect these neutrinos probably come from either supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies or from the death of very massive stars.
Ray, your book is partly about neutrinos, but it's partly about how science happens, as I'm reading it. And there's just so much coincidence. One of the main teams in this got together because they happened to be stuck in the same airport for a while. One key figure was a philosophy major who took a physics class and decided that was his thing. Just a lot of little stories like this. Are there things we can learn from the successes of the neutrino hunt that could inspire the science of the future?
For sure. I mean, I think it's the reason I was motivated and inspired to write this book is the richness of the history, the personalities, and the science. And it tells you that science is very much a human endeavor. It moves in in surprising ways and with surprising twists. And scientists who are involved in the neutrino hunt are very much, people of the world. They're affected by world wars. They, sometimes have to emigrate for family reasons. They have these unexpected encounters with colleagues that, where conversations lead to new ideas. It's very much about the process of science. And also, the other reason for bringing out this book right now is the, as marked by the Ice Cube discovery, the very recent discovery, neutrino research is really making it in prime time now. It's really opening up new directions and new insights about both the subatomic world and the universe at large.
Ray, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Rob.
That's Ray Jayawardena. He's a physicist, and his new book is Neutrino Hunters. Coming up, a little science closer to home in Wisconsin, some mysterious estrogen-like compounds found in some Wisconsin wells. We'll try to track down why they're there, where they might have come from. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Wednesday. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk about how whitefish are returning to some Wisconsin rivers after being absent for over a century. First, a new report out from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at higher levels of estrogenic compounds in well water in northeastern Wisconsin. Why are they there? Where do they come from? Not quite sure yet. Researchers think there could be a tie to all the dairy farmers in that region. Kate Golden joins us now to give us the details. She's a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So what hormones are we talking about, or what kind of compounds are we talking about in these wells in northeastern Wisconsin?
The short answer is we don't really know. So the researchers looked at well water in areas that already had a history of contamination. So it's not a random sample in these karst areas where water travels super fast straight into the groundwater from surface. It can often be contaminated. And what they found, they looked at chemicals. They looked for chemicals that would basically make breast cancer cells in the lab proliferate. So it's a hormone-sensitive breast cancer, and if you feed it hormones, then the cancer cells grow. So whatever was in the water made the cancer cells grow, and there were very slight amounts. It wasn't enough to tell people stop drinking their water, but it was enough to be worrisome.
Mm-hmm. And this is a controversial part of the story, I know, but where are these compounds coming from, or what's the mystery behind where they're coming from?
The mystery is that there are a lot of things that act like estrogen. So it could have been actual estrogen on cows in that area. There are tons of cows, way more cows than people. They produce a lot more waste than people. There's in Kewaunee County alone, I think the stat I used was that there's like 36 times more waste from cows than people there. But people take birth control pills, the estrogen, there are lots of industrial chemicals and personal care products and municipal sludge, and there's all sorts of chemicals that act like estrogen. So even though dairy farms and manure and pesticides are quite likely because of the volumes being put on the land, we really don't know what the chemicals were.
And the thought is this karst region that you mentioned, that the topography here, the landscape, makes it likely that possibly manure would have runoff that would quickly go into the groundwater supply. That's one of the possible culprits researchers are talking about.
I mean, that's already happening in this mm-hmm. area. That is an issue in this area. This is a particularly contaminated part of Wisconsin. The wells in the town of Lincoln, 51% of the wells tested were unsafe due to either nitrates, which are connected to agriculture, or bacteria, coliform bacteria. They're an indicator of some sort of contamination. In the rest of the area, it's more like maybe 30%, but not everybody tests their wells.
And how big a problem is that? Is that something that the DNR say or local governments are trying to get people to do more?
When I talked to local government officials, they said, you know, we don't know what effect this estrogen stuff has, but if your article does one thing, it will make people go out and test their wells.
And they could be testing for other things like E. coli, I think you mentioned in your article.
Yeah. If you test for bacteria and nitrates, that's kind of a basic thing to look for. And you come back with a positive for coliform bacteria, then you might want to go back and test for E. coli. If you live in an agricultural area, you might want to do a pesticide screen. There are metals to look for. Those are the big ones.
One of the concepts you introduced, or introduced me to, at least in the coverage, is the manure to cropland ratio. What is that, and how does it play into the water here?
Yeah, it was a new one for me, too. It basically describes how much acreage you have to spread the manure on. Manure is both a nutrient, it helps farmers, and it's also a waste. It's something you have to get rid of. And, you know, now that we have concentrated farming more and more, we have thousands and thousands of gallons of manure to deal with in Wisconsin. I think Gordon Stevenson, who used to run the runoff management section, estimated that Wisconsin cows produce more manure than the people in Mexico City and Tokyo produce waste. So that's a lot of manure, and we need some place to put it. And sometimes it goes into digesters and things like that, but basically it gets spread on the land, and the less land you have, the more likely that you spread too much or you spread when you shouldn't.
Getting back to the estrogenic compounds, these things that in at least some ways behave like estrogen, one of the health concerns here is that these can be endocrine disruptors, right? I hear about those in various environmental stories. What does that mean? What can they do to us?
Right. So we don't know, but endocrine disruptors, so the endocrine system is hormones flip the switches of your body's functions. It affects growth and regulation, development, your energy levels, all sorts of things. So endocrine disruptors are thought to be connected to hormone-related cancers, breast cancer, thyroid cancer, things like that. But they're also connected to a lot of other potential diseases. And scientists are still kind of figuring that out. With fish and wildlife, it's a little better known. We know that certain endocrine disruptors can feminize fish. They make male fish produce basically egg yolk proteins, and they start to do things that normally only females will do, things like that.
Now, you mentioned that the amounts of these estrogen-like compounds in the water they themselves aren't enough to warrant a don't drink this warning.
Right.
Is there a concern about a cumulative impact from the water, the well water, and other sources in our lives?
Yeah, we are being constantly exposed to endocrine disruptors. If you look at the antibacterial soap in the bathroom, it's got triclosan that's thought to be an endocrine disruptor. The flame retardants in your mattresses are most likely endocrine disruptors. We have our own, the more estrogen you're exposed to in your lifetime, the greater your risk for certain types of hormone-sensitive cancers. We are surrounded by these chemicals, and the amounts in the well water are very, very slight, but what concerned the researchers was this cumulative exposure.
What's the next step for the researchers at UW-Green Bay who are looking into this?
I don't know if there are going to be follow-ups. The next obvious step would be to take those well water samples and run them through some instruments that can tell you not just what the water can do, that it can exert some estrogenicity, but tell you what those chemicals are so you'd have an idea of what the source is. Is it estrogen produced by cows? Is it, hormones? Is it the ethinyl estradiol, the synthetic birth control pill from leaky septic systems? We don't know. But when I talked to the researchers, they didn't have access to that kind of equipment. They didn't have the money for it, and they would like to follow up, but they didn't have immediate plans to do that.
With the manure issue in particular, are there things that the DNR is doing or the state ag department is doing to try to deal with runoff into water supplies? Or is that still an open question?
So there are standards for, and like large farmers, CAFOs, who have the the confined animal feeding operations of 1,000 or more animal units at 700 dairy cows, they have to file these nutrient management plans that have very specific instructions on what they're going to do, how much manure they will apply where, how they're going to store it, things like that. There is a lot of controversy over that in northeastern Wisconsin because the land there is so vulnerable to contamination. A lot of the fissures in the ground and the karst features where water and runoff can just go straight down, they aren't necessarily visible on the surface. And there's controversy because basically, there is very little enforcement of nutrient management plans. It is a complaint-based enforcement, and there aren't the goal is to get one inspector every 5 years. I'm not sure that the DNR is actually making that goal.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kate Golden, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Up next, we'll learn why whitefish are returning to some Wisconsin rivers after more than a century, and what this could mean for the habitat. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Whitefish are returning to Wisconsin rivers. Over a century ago, the whitefish left Wisconsin's inland tributaries and has since primarily been fished in Lake Michigan. Now, they're returning, and it's created a bit of a puzzle for scientists. Whitefish are enjoyed in restaurants around Wisconsin, exported nationally, too. Here to discuss the comeback is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's environmental reporter, Lee Bergquist. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be on.
When did the whitefish start coming back to these rivers? And which rivers, I should ask first, are we talking about?
Well, there's four rivers that are where scientists and where biologists with the Department of Natural Resources and are seeing them. It's the Menominee River, the Oconto, Peshtigo, and the Fox. All of those are in northeastern Wisconsin on the Green Bay. All of them are tributaries to the Green Bay. It really began on the Menominee River way back in 1993, but it was just a few fish, just a very few whitefish. And really, until this year, there had been no other credible signs where there were spawning fish in any other river. And then this year, starting this fall, biologists began doing some more investigative work on other rivers because they had heard kind of anecdotally that there might be some whitefish on these other fish. And lo and behold, they came across them in all four of these rivers.
Now, they used to be common, right? But they disappeared over something like 140 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. They were on the Menominee, for example. They were from all the data that or all the old information that the DNR was able to glean. They were essentially gone by 1890. And since then, they were just gone. And then we've started to see this return of them. And I think what I heard was that, at that time, when you're on that river at Marinette, there was a huge timber industry, sawmills, a lot of activity on that river, and just the river was silted in. There wasn't the habitat that you see today.
And I see that at least the Menominee River itself has been part of a big rehab project from the DNR and then the cities of Marinette and Menominee, Michigan. How much progress have they made cleaning out those pollutants you were just talking about?
Well, I think they've made, if you probably would ask an ardent environmentalist that lives in the area, they would say it's not fast enough. It should have been done a long time ago. But there has been efforts to some cleanup work on that river. And I think the proof is that you have whitefish returning to that river. If there wasn't much cleanup work, on the Menominee, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't have this situation. Now, when you speak about cleanup work, really where a lot of the effort is on the Fox River in Green Bay, where you have the largest PCB cleanup project in the country. That's polychlorinated biphenyls, and they've cleaned up. They've spent well over $100 million on that project so far, and they still have several years of work to before they'll be done.
So when whitefish start moving back into a river, maybe it's too soon to answer this, I don't know, but are they just coming up to spawn and then heading back out to Lake Michigan, or are we seeing resident populations of whitefish staying in the river forever?
No. I think that is my understanding. It's primarily for spawning. They're generally lake residents, but and until this phenomena happened, they were just spawning in on reefs in Green Bay or out in Lake Michigan in certain areas, and they were spawning there. Now they're moving into these lakes, into these rivers, and they are going to spend, let's say, maybe a month in those rivers, and then they will, they will spawn, they'll do their business, and then they'll return back out to the lake. I think what's notable about that is that as the environment changes, as the ecosystems change, as things change, if you have that many more places where they're going to be spawning, and they're spawning in their original area in rivers where they were believed to have spawned, decades and decades ago, that's going to make for a stronger species in the long run.
How far upstream are we finding these guys so far?
So far, just a few miles. And in fact, on the Menominee, it's really only about a mile because there's a dam at that river. If that dam wasn't there, then they'd probably be farther up. And from what I understand, on the Econo and the Peshtigo, it's just, like a mile or so. With the Fox, it's probably farther up. It's probably several miles up the river at the Fox at the city of Green Bay.
You mentioned the Menominee River having pollutants. I assume the Fox River as well. There's still a thought that there's still work to go on all the rivers we're talking about as far as pollution. Is that right?
Oh, sure, sure. We've as a society, we've we treated rivers as open sewers for many, many years, and we really did a lot of damage to them, and beginning in 1970 with the Clean Water Act, where regulations went into place, things slowly began to turn around. The big area, of course, was these restrictions that were placed on wastewater treatment plants so that you couldn't just dump effluent right directly into the river. They have to be treated first. And, what's happening more so now is the non-point pollution parts of things, some of the material that's washing off from our streets and from farm fields, and there's some attempts to try to restrict what flows into the river, and that's all going to be helping these rivers as well in the future.
With the whitefish, one of the sub-puzzles of the big puzzle is that there are invasive species that researchers thought would make it hard for whitefish to come back. They seem to be doing okay around them. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. My colleague Dan Egan, who spends a lot of his time covering the Great Lakes issues, has written a lot about this as well. But these fish whitefish used to eat something called diaparaia, and it's a tiny shrimp-like creature that zebra mussels and quagga mussels, which are invasive species, basically wiped out a lot of these things. So that affected whitefish populations, but somehow, and nobody really has a good answer for this yet, but somehow these whitefish began to to change their appetites. They're now finding that they eat alewives, gobies, some of these same mussels, these invaders, they're eating those. And so that allowed the populations to increase again. And as those populations increased, they became very, in the last, beginning in about 2006, 2007, they became very popular for ice fishing on the Green Bay side, and populations rose. And that may be one explanation, this rising population, why these fish are moving from up into these tributaries.
The researchers you talked to, they've seen them in these four rivers. Are they saying, hey, maybe we should be going up and down the lake trying to find these guys in other rivers?
Yeah, I think that's the end game, is they want to look in other rivers to try to find them. And they do surveys from time to time, and you know, they have done surveys in the past. They're looking for whitefish, you know, on the Lake Michigan side, you know, from Green Bay down to Milwaukee, but they've seen no evidence of that whatsoever, and it's kind of a riddle as to why it is just in that area at this point. Probably just because there's, you know, a lot of whitefish in the Green Bay area, and I don't think anybody has knows. I think that's where more research needs to be done.
We'll give you more stories to cover and us more things to talk about as they try to track that. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Lee Bergquist. He's environmental reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.